The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM WHUS. I am Pedlin Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. This is episode 425 to be broadcast on Wednesday, December 25th, Christmas Day, on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, lovely Dr. Fran Storch. If you're watching on Facebook Live, you can always make your comments right down here below and we can get back to you. I'm feeling ridiculous because I'm wearing a Santa hat today. Anyway, this is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and are listening on Facebook Live, you can comment down below, or you can just send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's rant of the week. Here we go. UL safety standard legislation cut from the government bill. You know, that latest, you know, government shutdown threat that we seem to get all the time because no one in Washington can talk to one another? Well, apparently they made some cuts, and one of the cuts they did was to cut the safety standards for the lithium ion battery issues that were going on coming in from China. They removed it as they made their compromise to settle it out. Once again, the safety of people who ride bicycles or use them for transportation is not important in this country. But no worries, folks, because soon you'll not be able to afford any of the cheap knockoff fire hazard bicycles that are coming from China anyway. Did I mention tariffs? All right, I'm gonna talk more about this in the show. We'll get there. I'm not doing it right now. I'll move on now to the positive side. So the positive side, Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah. Yeah, tomorrow or the 25th, if you're listening to this on WHUS right now, you'll find that it is going to be December 25th. So we are celebrating here. I'm staying home, basically. Well, going out with my sisters. And then my sister's coming here in a couple days. My son's coming out from Chicago. Yay, it's Christmas. It's fun. It's the holidays. Hope you got all your Christmas shopping done. Or whatever. And anyway, so that's a thing. Okay, that's a positive thing. If you're into Festivus for the rest of us, that's fine too. I don't care. People for Bikes is celebrating the passage of an Explore Act, which is expanding access to outdoor recreation nationwide. That's a positive thing. We'll talk about that a little more in the show. And the Mechanical Minute and Ron's tips for the week. How cold is too cold to ride a bicycle outside? I have a little piece here from Fred Matheny, who has some words to share. I know I talk about this cold thing all the time, but we're up here in the Northeast, and, you know, it's cold up here. So this is what we have to deal with. Speaking of which, I woke up the other morning, and there were absolutely no degrees left. Yes, that's right. It was 0 Fahrenheit for those of you in the Celsius world. It was 0 Fahrenheit. You know how cold that is in Celsius. It's really cold. Probably not the best day to be on a bike. So we're going to go to this little piece here that came from the old Road Bike Rider. Okay. So this person had asked, they said they were riding when temperatures get above 25 degrees, but recently read about a pro says he never rides if it's below 40. That's me. I can't be tougher than a pro, can I? What's the minimum temperature for training outside? So Coach Fred Matheny says, if you're dressed correctly and you have the right equipment, you can ride outside regardless of the temperature. I did a bike racers. You know, I did a bike. It's kind of like the, I did a ride, but it's in a bike. Anyway, I know people who've done that before. Big tip of the Santa's cap for you if you've done that sort of thing. Yeeks. Seems too cold for me. Anyway, they'll ride and at below freezing, sometimes below zero temperatures for more than 24 hours before, you know, before they get done. And they're riding on packed snow and dodging ill-tempered moose. But there's a difference between riding outside and doing meaningful training. Although you can ride when your bottles freeze solid and icicles form on your balaclava, it's difficult to do an interval session in those conditions. Climbing is okay because you warm up from a combination of exertion and lack of air movement at slow speed, but then you freeze solid on the descent. So in cold temperatures, by far the most effective training is accomplished indoors on a trainer or a stationary bike. The specific temperature depends on your individual tolerance, road conditions, type of training you have planned, and other factors such as wind direction. The cutoff for many riders occurs between the 30 and 40 degree Fahrenheit range. When the temperature is freezing, including the wind chill factor, got to remember the wind chill factor, when the temperature, the trainer is probably a better option unless your objective is simply to get some fresh air or escape the trainer. And I know there are lots of no trainer people out there. And no trainer, no Zwift, no Ruvi, no, you know, no way I'm getting my butt on a bike indoors because it's just torture for my brain. Try a spin class. Show up with a bunch of other people that like to ride their bikes and suffer with them indoors together. It's not that bad. It really isn't. And if you get yourself a really good instructor, then you'll find that they can simulate a pretty darn good ride in an hour's worth of time that will make you go, wow, I never knew I could work that hard indoors on a bicycle. So, and you don't have to even work hard. You can just come, and we call it at our we call it the spin club. And so the spin club tends to be a I've just lost my audio thing. I've been having all sorts of technical difficulties today, so I'm going to have to do this over. But anyway, we call it Spin Club, and Spin Club is a, you know, it's just a bunch of people to get together really early in the morning, and we chit-chat about all sorts of things, but we also get a good workout in. So, you know, you get out of it what you put into it, and it's all up to you as far as that goes. As far as riding outdoors, don't hurt yourself, please, please, please. If you use that bicycle to commute with, then I totally get it. And, you know, it's a thing that happens, and you just gotta deal with it. That's all. But, you know, bundle up and don't go out there planning on, you know, dressing like Joe Bike Racer and going for a ride. You know, you may have to just like put a lot of really good clothes on and do it that way. It sometimes makes a lot more sense. So anyway, that is that's my basic cycling tip of the week. When is it too cold? It's always too cold out this time of year. I'm sorry. I'm just a weenie when it comes to the cold weather. I am truly a fair weather cyclist now that I have aged a little. When I was younger, I remember going out for rides in 18 degrees Fahrenheit and, you know, just went out and did it. Didn't think twice about it. I remember seeing friends of mine fall down on black ice when they were riding their bicycles also. Don't do that anymore. It's just, it isn't worth the injury and the possibility of an injury versus what you're going to gain from whatever training you think you're going to get at 18 degrees. It just doesn't make sense. So how cold is too cold to ride a bike outside? With me, 40 degrees Fahrenheit is probably about the limit that you're going to see me out there at, because otherwise it is just not pleasant. So I will move on. Let's go on to this UL safety standard legislation that was cut from the government funding bill, because, you know, I said it earlier when I stated the rant, you know, that it Unfortunately, bicycles are one of those things, and safety standards are one of those things in this country, the United States, that tend to be put aside. It's really funny because there's some people that are like really, really overprotective. We have all sorts of rules and regulations for all things that I would just kind of scratch my head about. And yet, then it comes to, oh, you mean lithium-ion batteries burning down houses and killing people and just starting fires and causing all sorts of problems? Nah, we can let that go. We don't need to pay attention to that. Drives me nuts. Anyway, it's kind of sad, but it is what it is. This came from Bicycle Retail and Industry News, and so the legislation was initially being included in the government funding bill, Setting Consumer Standards for Lithium Ion Batteries Act, is what it was called, was removed as Congress reached a compromise in time to prevent a government shutdown. The legislation, by Representative Richie Torres, of a Democrat from New York, would have given the Consumer Product Safety Commission authority to adopt a mandatory UL safety standard. The President Joe Biden signed the funding bill on Saturday, and President-elect Donald Trump and Elon Musk rallied Congress against the bipartisan deal after the draft budget resolution was released on Tuesday. I can guarantee you they did not go against the bill because it had not included the Consumer Standard for Lithium Ion Battery Act. They have other agenda on their mind. In a tweet on Thursday, Torres said it would not be included after all in the package that funds the government, though. And that funds the government through March 14th, includes $100 billion in disaster aid. Bicycle Retail and Industry News had reached out on Monday to Torres' office for an additional comment. The House Republicans removed the lithium ion battery safety legislation from their funding bill alongside crucial programs like SNAP protections and child cancer research, all in the name of fiscal responsibility. Don't save lives, save money. Okay, I said it. I did. I shouldn't, but I did. Just for it to lose dozens of Republican votes and fall decisively. Ridiculous. It's true. I know that there's been a lot of talk in the news over this last year or two of these apartment house fires in New York City because of all these. I'll tell you, the working people of the world that actually use a bicycle to help them with their work, they tend to use the bike because it's an inexpensive way for them to transport themselves around the city. Plus, they're delivery people, and they are much more efficient on a bicycle than they are by using a car. Car is just a massive piece of, what can I say? I'm not going to say the bad word. It's just too big and too inconvenient, and makes it difficult to get from one place to another place to another place with any kind of efficiency. And if you're that type of service person, you're looking for efficiency because people want their things on time. So therefore, the bicycle just makes a lot of sense. And so, what would happen was a lot of these folks that were doing this type of delivery, they were all living in the same place. And I saw a picture from, gosh, it was from, I can't even remember where I saw it, was someplace online. I saw a picture of the reasons why they're having problems, and there were, I'm telling you, extension cords with all sorts of charges all going through that one extension cord into that one outlet, and they're just overloading the circuits, and all it took was one faulty charger to shut the whole thing down and burst into flames, and now the building's on fire. So when you've got, 15 or 20 bicycles all plugged into a one outlet or maybe two outlets, it's a recipe for disaster. And you know what really needed to happen is that the buildings needed to get rewired so that people could, you know, do this safely. But now that's a big ask. That's a big ask because, you know, the landlords say, no, they don't care. Well, they don't care. They're insured. They don't have a problem with it. But when somebody dies in a fire, that's a big deal. Now, why, you may ask, are all the delivery people using e-bikes? Well, it's a really good reason. They're carrying heavy packages. They're on the bikes all day long. They really need that extra little bit of power to get themselves around. And it's a great vehicle for what they're doing. Makes a lot of sense. So anyway, that's what we have. We have this battery legislation that wasn't included in the latest government threatened shutdown. And unfortunately, there will be, this will probably come up again. And I'll add to the unfortunate part of that. And that could be that we probably won't see this for the next 4 years. So if you are one of those folks that's living in a big city that has a whole bunch of bicycle messengers and bicycle delivery people in your building, you might want to just double check and make sure that they're safely plugging them in and operating them in a safe manner, because, you know, I would be nervous if I were you. I'd be real nervous. I certainly would want to make sure I kept my batteries up in my smoke detector. Anyway, that's because it's about all you can really do. I mean, other than, you know, report the overuse and overburden of the outlets to the proper authorities and have someone come in there and take care of it, you're kind of sitting on a time bomb. Kind of stinks. So anyway, that's what's going on, and thank you, federal government, for paying so close attention to something that's really useful and necessary and has to do with bicycles. That note of sarcasm. That's what we're dealing with next. So let's go look down the list here and see what else I've got here. I've got, let's see. So, e-mobility risks. That's another thing. So, New York City faces a perfect storm with e-mobility risks. So, where is this? What happened to it? And not that one, but that will be coming soon. This came from People for Bikes, I believe, on this one. People for Bikes. I got a few things I got from People for Bikes today that I'll share with you. This is by Matt Moore, a policy counselor, and he goes on to talk about a disproportionate number of fatalities related to fires from unsafe and untested lithium-ion batteries used in e-mobility products are occurring in New York City. But why? Because there's a couple of things going on here. The expense of an e-bicycle that is coming out of China direct. You gotta point your finger where the finger needs to be pointed. If they can get them into this country unregulated, and somebody is making money off of that, and they can get them in here unregulated, they're just going to sell them by the thousands, because their inexpensive transportation in the minds of those that are purchasing them. Unfortunately, not everyone can afford to go to the local bike shop and buy a really nice and expensive e-bike. Yes, it is a nice hat, Pete. You like that? You should get one of these. These are fun. Anyway, I'm getting comments here. So here's the problem. Unsafe and untested lithium ion batteries have contributed to 40 deaths nationwide related to lithium-ion battery fires, 72% of them occurred in New York City alone. Because, you know, New York City is New York City. Thankfully, there is some good news on the last front. According to Underwriters Laboratories, that's UL that I had mentioned earlier, deaths from e-bike fires declined in New York City after battery safety standards were written into law. Say goodbye to those. At the same time, the number of fires and deaths rose rapidly from near zero prior to 2020 to a peak of hundreds of fires and 18 deaths in 2023. So far in 2024, only four people, still four too many, died from battery-related fires in the city. The progress is no doubt due to the passage of ordinances that require lithium-ion batteries used in all e-mobility devices to be tested and certified by accredited third-party laboratories, ongoing public education, and diligent enforcement efforts by the Department of Consumer and Worker Protection and the New York City Fire Department, including shuttering some of the worst violators and going after online sellers who openly sell substandard batteries. Yeah, here we go. So this is where the problem is, and if you don't regulate this sort of thing, then you end up with tragedy, and it is grim data for sure. And, you know, we have entirely different regulations for motorized vehicles in this country and much stricter in some ways than the non-motorized type or even the e-bike style. It's just there's And then there's the issue of people riding their bicycles and people driving behemoth vehicles and running them over. And it's just, you know, we just need to slow everybody down. Slow down, take your time, don't drive in a city over 20 or 25 miles per hour because you're going to hurt someone, maybe even yourself, you know. It's a thing. And those of you who are riding bikes and e-bikes in the city, watch out for the pedestrians, please. Did you know that two pedestrians were killed this past year by people riding e-bikes and crashing into them? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can happen. It's we are all in too big a hurry to get to where we have to go and not paying attention to what we're doing because we're all incredibly distracted. When I see someone riding their bike down the road and looking at their cell phone, that's the final, oh my God, you gotta be kidding me. Put the damn phone away. Put it away because there is no reason for you to be using the phone while you're riding your bike. Pay attention. Nor driving your car, but we won't even get into that because everybody does that. And I mean, everybody does that. So New York City had 47% of the nationwide e-bike fatalities, even though its residents only account for 2.5% of the U.S. So that's what we got. And it's a prevalence for delivery workers in New York, an estimated 65,000 people performing the difficult and dangerous work of delivering meals and goods by bicycle, e-scooter, or e-bike, or moped could also be a factor. So that's another issue that comes up. And this is where they run into the problems. So what it is about New York City in particular that led it to have both 72% of the fire deaths and 47% of the e-bike related deaths from traffic violence. This may be insistence where we should blame the e-bikers because New York City has that type of e-bike that exists nowhere else on the planet. They legalized electric bicycles in 2020. The legal definition of included a class 3 e-bike that can go 25 miles per hour by use of a throttle. In virtually every other state and under federal law, that vehicle is considered a motor vehicle because it can exceed 20 miles per hour on motor power alone. 43 states now follow the People for Bikes Model 3 class definitions and require a class 3 e-bike to only provide pedal assistance, not direct motor power. What happened in New York City was that no major e-bike manufacturer was willing to make an e-bike that wasn't legal to sell or operate anywhere else and was likely subject to federal motor vehicle safety standards. The result should have been foreseeable in 2020, but it has now become painfully clear in hindsight. Thousands of cheap e-bikes with unsafe speed capability and low quality batteries were made by a few foreign companies and sold to a vulnerable population. So, you know, be careful what you're buying. If you're buying anything like that for yourself, be really, really cautious. Make sure it's certified. Make sure it has a UL rating on it. And the best way to do that is I'll go back to the good old local bike shop. The local bike shop can give you a quality unit, at least one that has passed and been certified in so many directions. And, you know, that would be a good thing. But that's what we got. So what else do we have here on the list today? Enough of that e-bike stuff. And they are everywhere. Let me tell you, they are truly everywhere. So I had mentioned, speaking of e-bikes, I'm not done yet. Should you buy your kid an e-bike? With the, this is another People for Bikes article. It came out most recently, just like a week ago or so. And, you know, people are in the Christmas shopping season, holiday shopping season, so they're looking at e-bikes. And the People for Bikes legal expert weighs in on what to look for ahead of your holiday shopping season. First of all, the whole idea of putting your child on a bicycle that can accelerate with very, very little effort is, to me, if you're a conscientious parent of any kind, of any measure whatsoever, why would you do that? Why? Do you give them the keys to your automobile when they're, you know, 5 years old, 6 years old? No, you don't. You know why? Because they're going to crash the car. It's not going to work. So why give them something that they can't handle under their own power? And let's add to that the whole physical fitness thing that goes along with it. You know, the whole idea of keeping a healthy child, because therefore you'll hopefully have less health concerns in the future because you've taught the child how to ride a bicycle and they get the physical exercise that's necessary and which to propel that bicycle forward. Oh my God. I would say this is going to be one of those cell phone things. Okay, let's kind of look at this. We'll look at this in the direction of, well, Bobby and Susie down the street, they have cell phones. Why can't I have a cell phone? And that's where it all begins. And then you take a look at what you want your children to see or not see. And so you say, well, you know the story. Your parents must have said, if Bobby or Susie jumps off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge too? My mom used to say that one all the time. Anyway, you know, you have to exercise common sense and you have to understand what your child can handle. And it's tricky enough to get them on a bicycle under their own power and have them be safe on the road. But then to give them power on top of that, this just does not make sense. Young riders are more often and more inclined to take risks and may be less familiar with the rules of the road. Whether your child should join their ranks is a question that requires some serious parental consideration and a bit of investigation. There's a certain level of responsibility here, in my eyes, as a cyclist and as someone who has put a lot of people on bicycles in my lifetime, and also a lot of kids on bicycles in my lifetime, that there's some sort of a legal obligation here. I mean, if you are and if your child goes out and does something terrible on this bike, unregulated, then whose fault really is it? That's a good question. And that is a question that I know goes around in other various things that are purchased for children that probably shouldn't be purchased for children or allowed by parents. But, you know, this is the world we live in. We live in the land of excess. And if somebody has something, then somebody else wants the same something or one better than the person next door. It's just weird. I don't know. It's what it is. And hey, and it's Christmas, so people are buying all sorts of things like this. So in most places, an electric bike is legally defined as a type of vehicle with specific limitations on its motor power and speed. Under federal law, electric bicycles must have working pedals, motors of less than 750 watts, and go no faster than 20 miles per hour on motor power alone without pedaling. Almost all states have similar laws, and 43 states further define electric bikes into those three distinct classes according to their capabilities. So the question is, should you buy your kid an e-bike? My answer, I'm going to be real opinionated about this. And, you know, if you disagree, please write me. Please comment below. I love to hear what you have to say. But to me, it really, unless the child has a disability of some sort and really, really needs that under them, don't do it. Don't do it. I see these people, they buy these motorized little like pseudo cars. They sell them at, you know, the big box stores, and you know, they got batteries in them, and so they can drive them around. And I just like shake my head and go, I have a bike. I have a bike instead. Speaking of buying bikes, we're gonna go on to a happier part of the show here, because, you know, it's Christmas, and therefore we should do this sort of thing. It would be kind of fun. So we will move on here and get ourselves a little bit deeper into the show, and like I said, to a hollier and jollier part of the show. But first off, People for Bikes is celebrating a passage of the Explore Act, expanding access to outdoor recreation nationwide. So People for Bikes strongly advocated for bipartisan legislation that looks to improve and expand America's outdoor recreation economy while delivering sustainable economic boosts to rural communities. So it was the Bipartisan Expanding Lands Outdoor Recreation Experiences, or called Explore Act, and unanimously passed by the U.S. Senate on December 19th, and now heads to President Biden's desk to be signed into law, first introduced by the U.S. House of Representatives, Bruce Westerman, Republican from Arkansas, and Roel Rajava, a Democrat from Arizona. The bill passed in the House in April. The Explore Act aims to improve and grow America's outdoor recreation economy while delivering sustainable economic boosts to rural communities. The comprehensive package includes several groundbreaking recreation bills, including the Military and Veterans Parks Act, Outdoors for All, Outdoor Recreation Act, Biking on Long Distance Trails Act, and many others. Maybe we are finally going to see that coast-to-coast bike trail. Wouldn't that be cool? Can you imagine if there was a trail, and apparently, by the looks of things, it is 60% there at this time. Don't hold me on that, but I believe I had read that somewhere. So there is a possibility that, you know, we could connect the two coasts and have a protected bike path the whole way. How cool would that be? Definitely wasn't there when I rode my bicycle across the country, but anyway, that was a long time ago. This does have funding for taking care of things like that, for adding to those multi-use trails, and that's a good thing. That's a good thing. So that was part of my positive side. But let's go to something else here. Let's see here. Where is it? Where is it? So here's a story for you, and it's this actually comes from NPR's StoryCorps, and I also read it somewhere else before I actually saw it listed on NPR. But it was Christmas Eve in 1967. William Lynn Weaver, 18 at the time, was walking in Mechanicsville, a neighborhood he grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee, when he saw a boy gliding down the street on a bicycle. "Boy, that looks like my brother's bike," he mused. When he got home, he asked his younger brother Wayne where his bicycle was. "It was down on the steps," he replies, but it wasn't. The Weaver brothers tracked down where the boy lived, an unlit shack in an alley, and planned to confront him. "Now, my brother and I were going to beat this boy, but my father was there, and he said, 'Just shut up and let me talk.'" This is the story that happened. An elderly man with a cane answered their knock at the door. The home appeared cold and dark, and he had a single candle for light. His grandson, Weaver learned, was the boy who had stolen the bike. "He was the same age as my brother, about 10 years old," Weaver says. The little boy starts crying and says, "I just wanted something for Christmas." They took the bike and they walked home. "My father tells my mother, and she doesn't say anything," Weaver says. "She just starts cutting the turkey in half and all the fixings. She started packing it up." He says, "My father went to the coal yard, got a big bag of coal, and when he told my brother, he said, 'You've got another bike, don't you?' My brother said, 'Yeah.' And the three of them returned to the shack in the alley, this time with food, some coal to provide heat, and the bike. The little boy is just crying, but the thing that moved me the most was the old man. The father gave him $20, which was a huge deal back then, and said, 'Merry Christmas.' The man said, 'Thank you,' and broke down in tears," Weaver says. "My father was my chauffeur, was a chauffeur. My mother was a domestic, so we didn't have a lot of stuff. And after Christmas, I don't remember what gift I got, but I do know that made me feel better than any Christmas I've ever had." What a great story. Kindness is an amazing, amazing thing. And I think this is the point I'm getting to. We need to be a lot kinder. We're approaching the new year. We're approaching a lot of craziness going on here in the United States, where a lot of people here are very, very anxious about what's going to happen in January. And I'm along with them. I'm definitely there. But, if you just keep living your life in a kind way, I think everything will work out. That's how I was brought up. That's how I plan to leave the earth as I came onto the earth. And again, if there's anything you can do to help anybody that is in need, it's Christmas Eve here, and it will be Christmas tomorrow when this broadcast comes out. So, let's think a little bit more about who we are and what we are doing in our lives. So that's one of my positive Christmas stories. But guess what? There's another one. Yeah, I'm getting all sappy here today. And this one is entitled "An Older Brother's Gift." All right. This was based around a contest. And it was Christmas season in 1994. 9-year-old Jaron and his 6-year-old brother Parker were excited. They had entered a reading contest sponsored by a grocery store in their hometown. The two students who read the most books would each win a brand new bicycle. All they had to do was have their parents and teachers sign for each book they read. Two bikes were to be awarded, one to for the first to third grade levels and one for the fourth to sixth grade levels. This boy Parker was especially excited because on his way for him to earn a bike, he really wanted one. He was tired of watching his older brother ride around on the new purple 10-speed bike he had earned while working at a yard sale. Parker thought it would be great to earn a bike of his own by reading books, so he started reading books as fast as he could. He read Curious George, Green Eggs and Ham, and Brown Bear, Brown Bear, but no matter how many books he read, someone in his grade level had read more. Meanwhile, Jaron, his brother, had not been all that enthusiastic about the contest when he went to the grocery store and checked out the big chart with all the readers listed and how many books each had read. However, he could see that his younger brother had little chance of winning in the contest. Touched with the true meaning of Christmas, the joy of giving, he decided to do for Parker what he could not do for himself. So Jaron put away his own bike and library card in hand, went to work. He read and read and read. He read when he wanted to ride his bike. He read as much as 8 hours a day. The thrill of perhaps having such a wonderful gift kept him going. The day came when his finalists were to be turned in, and Jaron's mother took him to the store, and he turned to his list and admired the prize winner bicycles on display. The store manager watched him admire the shiny red 20-inch bike. "I suppose if you win the contest," the manager said, "you'll want the larger bike, won't you?" Jaron looked up at the man's smiling face and said very seriously, "Oh, no, sir. I would like ex this one exactly this size." "But isn't that bike too small for you?" "No, sir. I want to win this for my little brother." The man was surprised. He turned to Jaron's mother and said, "This is the best Christmas story I've heard all year." Jaron's mother hadn't known that he had worked so hard for his little brother. She took Jaron, looked at Jaron in great pride and joy as they went home to await the contest results. Phone Paul finally came in. By reading 280 books, Jaron had won. With his parents' help, he hid the bicycle in his grandmother's basement until Christmas Eve. He could hardly wait to give Parker his gift. So on Christmas Eve, the whole family gathered at grandma's home for a special family home evening. And of course, there were all sorts of stories of the meaning of Christmas and great sacrifices that people make for each other and for each of us. And she said it was a sacrifice and showed how much the older brother loved his younger brother. Parker and his family listened to the story of a brother who had read 280 books to win his little brother's bike. "My big brother would do something like that for me," Parker said. After that, Jaron ran into the other room where Grandma had moved the bike. The rest of the family proudly grinned when he wheeled out two-wheeled treasure he had earned for his younger brother. Parker ran over to the bike, and the brothers hugged over the top of it. Christmas story. I feel like the Hallmark Channel here today. I'll try not to get too heavy into this, but anyway, yeah, we're a little savvy, but you know, it's Christmas Eve, so I gotta do the Christmas Eve thing. We're gonna move on to other things in our show here today. I have a couple more things to talk about. The stolen bicycle one we did, we got all this. let's go to bike racing. I gotta go there for a little bit. It's cyclocross season. Things are going crazy out there in the cross world. And yeah, Matthew Vanderpoel. We talk about Matthew Vanderpoel a lot. He has some amazing genetics in place. He's He's the son of a bicycle racer, professional bicycle racer. He's the grandson of a very, very, very special bicycle racer. And this guy is not only a great road cyclist, but he is, before that, a great cyclocross racer. And I think it's just because I have seen his stats. I've seen the amount of wattage this guy can put out, and he's just a monster on the bike. He just, when he needs wattage, he's got it. And he puts out serious, incredible watts, making him a really, really strong cyclocross racer. So there's a couple things you really need to be able to ride cross well. One is you have to have a great strength to weight ratio because you're going to be working super hard a lot of times trying to power your bicycle through whatever is in front of you, whether it be a steep incline, whether it be deep sand, whether it be mud. It's all going to affect your legs and the amount of wattage you can put out in those legs for the weight that you're carrying. And Matthew Vanderpoel, after watching him in some of the classics, putting out 1600 watts climbing a hill, obviously has the credits to do this sort of thing. So he dominated the thick sand sections under rainy conditions to win the super prestige Mol Zalmermeer Cross on Monday. The world champion launched a searing attack with 4 laps to go and was briefly joined by Laurens Wieck of Crelan-Carillon, but however, the latter was faltered through the ruts and the sand and most lost valuable time, but managed to finish in second place, 1 minute and 3 seconds back. And the he so he won the World Cup, and he continues success at the start of the week, next week, and he won the mole in the following day. So he's just amazing, and I just don't understand how you can have that kind of power, but I'm gonna say genetics has a lot to play here. Raymond Poulidor, by the way, otherwise known as Poo Poo, was Matthew's grandfather, and he was just an amazing cyclist. So they come from good genes, good gene flow there. Lots of amazing genetics going on. He ended up leading the race by 25 seconds at the start of the 7th and 10th laps and showed no signs of slowing down. He continues to extend his lead over a minute during the remaining laps and cross the finish line to take his second win of the season. So Matthew is back. Yes, he is. I don't see Wout van Aert here yet. And maybe Wout has finally decided that he does not want to race cross anymore. That is a possibility. But you never know. It could happen. Hey, here's one for you. The Giro. So the Giro d'Italia in 2025. We've been getting a lot of mixed reports about, what's going on with the Giro, and there was some funding and some speculation, delays and doubts. The organizers of the Giro have confirmed that the 2025 Corsa Rossa will start in Albania across the Adriatic from the Italian mainland. The 2025 Giro d'Italia will start on Friday, March 9th, early. It's usually in April. Okay, Friday, March 9th, with 3 testing stages in Albania before the race caravan travels to Puglia in southern Italy for an early rest day on May 12th. The remaining 18 stages head north, with mountain stages in the northeast and then the northwest, as in recent years. The Giro will finish in the capital of Rome on June 1st. How do you start on March 9th? This cannot be, this has to be wrong. It must be April 9th, because that makes no sense whatsoever. 18 stages and then finishing. I think this is a typo. I pulled this down. I'm like, God, this seems awfully early, but I think that's exactly what it is. The full Giro d'Italia route will be revealed in Rome on January 13th. So we'll know a little bit more about it then, and we'll see what's going on. But yeah, it should make it interesting. And yeah, that has to be a typo. It has to be a typo. So I think April 9th is what we're looking at, because I saw March 9th. And I went, why would they start so early? And then when I just read the finish, that obviously isn't going to work. So it's going to start in Durres, one of Albania's major cities, and then heads inland to climb Gracian, a 13.5-kilometer climb at 5.2%. The race will then continue to the capital, Tirana, where 22.2-kilometer circuit will be completed twice, featuring the third category, Sorel climb. The last time over the climb is less than 12 kilometers to the finish line, perhaps sparking attacks and hurting the sprinters and their lead outs. Stage two is going to be a 13.7-kilometer individual time trial, and there'll be an early test for the overall contenders. So we will see maybe something good here. The third and final stage in Albania is a hilly 160-kilometer race around Biore, where that hosts both the start and the finish. And there is going to be a 10.7-kilometer at 7.4% will be tackled 39 kilometers from the finish, with the last 25 kilometers flat, so that a chase for the chasers is open for to close any gaps. So we've avoided the cliche of a start for sprinters, said Giro d'Italia race director Mauro Vegni. The first stage was a testing circuit, but the time trial has a mid stage and third stage as a major climb in the lake. So anyway, we'll see what happens. It's a new start for them. They do that sometimes. Sometimes they just start in, you know, different places. Remember the year they started in the Middle East? That was interesting. Anyway, it's what it is. It's the Giro. It's this year's Giro. So I think that we are getting very, very close to running ourselves out of time, but I have a little piece here I can still talk about. Jonathan Vaughters, he runs the U.S. team, the Education First team. Very good bike racer back in his day, and now he's gotten into the industry, so to speak. And he has a story here in Cycling News, and they interviewed him, and he says, in cycling, you can't just buy success. Jonathan Vaughters on financial fairness, super teams, and the sponsorship dilemma. And his comment is, there should be some attempt to regulate the way riders are recruited, the way teams are constructed, and what is considered sort of financially fair. So, you know, he was very, very outspoken in this article. Apparently, the contracts in cycling are becoming longer. The best young talents are being snapped up early, and just as recently as Wednesday, the UAE Team Emirates insured one of the brightest prospects in the peloton, John Christian, wouldn't be going anywhere until at least 2030. Wow, they're holding on to him for a long time. He's the third rider on the Emirates team to sign a contract until the end of the current decade, after 18-year-old Pablo Torres and the sport's current pinnacle, Tadej Pogacar, did the same earlier this offseason. As more money has come into the sport in recent years, the super teams have dominated the transfer market, buying out riders from their contracts at smaller teams, locking down all the best talents as early as they can, and ensuring they have the best chance of winning the biggest races now and in the next generation. But how does this work for the sport of of racing and how does it harm racing? There's a dominance throughout the sport's history, of course. However, this is now largely unregulated transfer system that is allowing top budget teams, UAE, Emirates, Lisa, Visma, Lisa Bike, and now Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe to stay on top. Jonathan Waters isn't happy with it, so I understand. He's trying to run a U.S. team, which we are here in the United States. We just really have a problem with funding cycling in so many ways, especially the sport where no one really understands it here and what's going on. And this is gonna be a big setback, I think, for U.S. cycling, which is really unfortunate because we have some amazing, talented riders coming out of the U.S. right now. But it's business. It's all business. That's the way it works. So the UCI had made some changes into the way that transfers are to be conducted midway through the 2024 season. However, this was largely reactionary after the messy transfer of a rider from Bora to Visma Lisa Bike. So we'll just have to see what happens. It could be a very, very interesting year. Obviously, Tadej Pogačar is getting better. Hard to believe he can get better. He is certainly holding his own as far as his ability to move a bike. There's no question about that. And with age and experience and maturity and in the bike racing peloton, one tends to make smarter decisions. And he didn't make a lot of smart decisions when he was younger, but he was still just so darn powerful and strong. It was really hard to beat him. So, there is that too. Anyway, that's what's going on there. I'm going to finish things up here because we are getting towards the end of the show. And remember, the Giro starts on April 9th, not March 9th. That was silly. And Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah. You know that cycling really can change the world, right? Hey, Congress, get your heads out of your bottom brackets. If we are going to change the way we transport ourselves in the cities in this country, we should not have to worry about the quality standards of unregulated bikes. So, how was your 2024? Did you ride more miles, ride to commute to work or around town, better fitness, or simply enjoy the bicycle rides you take more by slowing down and smelling the roses? I'm going to say it again, it won't be my last time. Get loud, get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, the price of gas, the lack of places to safely ride your bike, and just ride your bicycle instead. Park the car, park the truck. One day, that's all I ask. That's the Pedal and Run Challenge. And you might just surprise yourself. You really might. This holiday season, I'd like you to please be safe and be kind. I hope you all have a great time. Getting together with friends and family, etc. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, lovely Dr. Franz Dortch. If you're watching on Facebook Live, you can leave comments down here below, or you can send me an email if you're listening to an audio file, Bicycle Talk, the numeral 1@gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. This is Pedalin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. See you next week. Ride your bike, ride!